Hello, good evening. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. And I will be your host tonight with our continuing special coverage of the coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic in our region as well as in the country and throughout the world. As you may know, Louisiana is currently the hardest hit in our listening area, and cases in the Shreveport-Bossier area are increasing. We talk a lot about this area tonight because hopefully we will share some information with you about this virus that can be beneficial to all of the listeners out there. We have two excellent guests with us tonight. We have Dr. Nambia, from Clinical Assistant Professor of Infectious Diseases here at LSU Health in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Chris Kevel, Vice Chancellor for Research here at LSU Health as well here in Shreveport. Dr. Kevel is actually part of a team who is involved in setting up and operating a new emerging viral threat lab here at LSU Health here in Shreveport. First of all, I'd like to welcome Dr. Kevel. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Dr. Nambiar, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me.
And as we are practicing social distancing, our guests are joining us remotely tonight. So I am here in the studio solo, as it were, participating in social distancing, which is so important for everyone to practice right now. Again, if you have a question, you still can call, and we will have a phone bank operator in a separate room take that call and message me with your question or comment. The number for questions or comments is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. So, Dr. Kevel, update us, if you will, with the type of research that's going on with the coronavirus here at LSU Health in Shreveport.
Right. So currently right now, our institution has a group of national and internationally recognized virologists that have been funded by both the National Institutes of Health and other agencies. And while previously, our group had not really focused on coronaviruses. They'd focused on many other viruses. The expertise that we have here at our institution, being an academic medical center, and in particular in our campus, really has allowed us a unique opportunity to stand up what is now called the Emerging Viral Threat Laboratory. And this was done in response to the early observations that had happened at the University of Washington, where, as many will remember, in Seattle, the virus crashed into the U.S., if you will. And Dr. Andrew Urochko, as well as Dr. Martin Sapp in the Department of Microbiology, had colleagues up there, and also colleagues at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, and they all began corresponding with one another. And it became very apparent that we had the capability here at our institution to do the testing, the diagnostic testing that's essential for identifying individuals that are infected by the virus. And so within a matter of no more than 12 days, actually boots on the ground more like 10 days, 2 days of planning, we were able to stand up the Emerging Viral Threat Laboratory through actions of a whole host of individuals that were really instrumental in doing this. Dr. Martin Sapp, Dr. Urochko, Mr. Drew Mouton, the whole virology and microbiology research team were really critical in standing this up, as well as the administration at LSU Health Science Center to make sure we get the regulatory approvals, get the equipment in, and get all the reagents available and lined up to do the testing.
So what's the process to get a lab set up like that? Is that something that you have to get expedited national certification for?
Yes. Actually, normally to set a lab up like this, it would have taken many months, probably 3-4 months if you're being rather quick about it. We were fortunate. The governor, Governor Edwards, was highly receptive and really helped facilitate getting approvals done very quickly. And in fact, he signed several executive orders that allowed us to be able to bypass certain restrictions and engage the federal government, in particular the Centers for Medicaid Services, CMS, as well as the FDA. And between the federal disaster declarations that had been made, as well as the state declarations that had been made, we really were able to get to standing up the laboratory and extending certification that we had already had in our cancer center genomic testing laboratory, because this actually utilizes a genomic test, so that we could use that as a springboard or a model to lift this test really quickly. So we took what normally would have taken several months to no more than a week and a half.
And, you know, from the standpoint of this particular laboratory, you mentioned research and you mentioned clinical testing. So is this laboratory performing both functions? Is it a clinical test that can actually test individuals? And is it also doing research on the virus simultaneously?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's exactly what we did. Was we designed the laboratory to be flexible. So the laboratory has a flexible testing platform where we can take in samples from various sources, validate them on our system. We have a robot that actually is used to extract the RNA from the virus so that we can minimize the amount of handling that people need to have with this, which is increases safety. And at the same time, it increases the speed, because we want to make sure we get the results done quickly and turned out into the to the folks who ordered it and to the physician's hands real fast. But in addition to that, we know that there are at least 8 different strains of the coronavirus that are now infecting humanity across the planet. And many of our researchers really want to better understand that. And as we're now seeing that coronavirus does not discriminate based on age, race, sex, et cetera, it's really important to know what are these strains of coronavirus that are directly affecting us here in Louisiana, because there may be something that is more unique, or perhaps genetic susceptibility of individuals that do poorly with a viral infection. But unfortunately, we just don't know that yet. So now we're in a position as an academic medical center to contribute to not only the important scientific knowledge, but also do a medical diagnostic test that will help take care of the patients at the same time.
Yeah, so that's obviously going to lead to certain other questions. So, for example, when you perform a test on an individual, are you going to give them the results positive or negative? And if positive, are we actually going to be able to provide any further information to them, such as if it is a more virulent strain or not?
So, yes, we definitely give that information regarding positive or negative to their treating physician, and their physician is able to give them that diagnosis. Regarding whether there's a more virulent strain or not, we're just not there yet. We don't know which of the 8 strains do they have differential virulence potency, if you will, or more severity with certain individuals. So we don't have that capability to tell people yet. Again, you know, you probably read or hear interviews in the media. This pandemic is still in its infancy. And one of the things I'm constantly in awe by is how quickly humanity, and more importantly, the healthcare professionals and the scientists, have come together to address this pandemic. That otherwise, back in 1918, it had taken 2 or 3 years to get to the point where we are, if ever. So we don't yet know which strain would be worse off, if you will, for one individual or another. But we hope to get to that point in the not-too-distant future.
So with the information that you're collecting now, are you going to be cross-referencing that back to clinical outcomes?
Yes, that is exactly the plan. And in fact, there are many teams that my office and the Vice Chancellor for Research office has set up. And one of them here was the EVT laboratory. And now that that stood up, it's ramping up into fuller production mode. But now we're also really engaging the research arm and clinical trials arm. because one of the things that we know through both collaboration and talking with other individuals at different academic medical centers across the country is that they're not only different manifestations of the disease, because some people get certain signs and symptoms, some people don't. We know the obvious common ones, which is the fever, the dry cough, the myalgia. But there are other aspects of the disease that some people get and some people don't. And the idea is to be able to share that knowledge so that we can not only better diagnose patients, but more importantly, identify better ways to treat them, given the fact that we don't have a vaccine, and that a vaccine is certainly not in the terribly distant horizon, but is certainly well a ways off, certainly in the neighborhood of 12 months or so away. So we really do need to understand the best way to take care of these patients, and on top of that, identify the individuals who are really going to be very susceptible to this disease, so that when they come into the hospital, we can identify if those are indeed the individuals that we're seeing, and then put in place a treatment protocol that would help give them the greatest chance for survival and the greatest chance for recovering from this disease.
So as the lab stands now, are they currently accepting specimens from healthcare providers?
Yes, we are. In conjunction with our clinical partner, the Ochsner LSU Health Science, our health system, we are accepting specimens and have been reading those and giving those results back to them. They have also recently stood up additional testing in their laboratory, and so now that's allowed us to begin to focus on needs outside of our immediate circle. So, for example, nursing homes in the community or other assisted living type of facilities, as well as first responders, which is a high priority item, and we're in the process of working through that.
What's the time that it takes to get the result back?
Right.
In your laboratory?
For our test, utilizes the gold standard, if you will. It's called PCR, which is an abbreviation for polymerase chain reaction. And this is a high-complexity genomic test that the robot extracts the RNA out of a specimen, which is several hours. The PCR then takes several hours. But through the process of having the sample delivered, being extracted, being analyzed by PCR, and then reporting out, that report time, if you will, from taking the specimen and getting a result is in the neighborhood of about 36 to 48 hours. But we're working to speed that up very much to where it could be 24 hours. Many of your listeners may have heard that there are new tests that are out there that give you results in 5 minutes or 45 minutes. And those are different variations on a theme. They don't necessarily use a traditional PCR method. They use other molecular biology methods, but those technologies are coming into Louisiana and are being stood up not only at our healthcare facility, but at other places around the state, so that more quick responses can be given in addition to these traditional responses.
A standard sort of point of care test, if you will, is, it's a good screen, but as we know, we need specificity when really treating a disease. Do you know if there's a valid comparison with these quick point-of-care tests versus what you call the gold standard PCR test?
Yeah, that's a great question. To my knowledge, I have not seen literature yet to do a head-to-head comparison. What I will say that actually our virologists, hats off to them, I mean, they're just a super, super incredible team, is that this assay, depending upon the level of precision to detail, et cetera, can vary from user to user, from person to person. And so these rapid tests, you're right, as a point of care, really just identify the, say, for example, a super shedder, as Dr. Martin Sapp would say, that somebody who's really releasing loads and loads of virus, somebody who's not releasing a tremendous amount of virus or didn't get a large viral load, may not have a lot of copies of the virus. And so maybe those point of care devices might not be as sensitive to pick that up. Fortunately for us, our testing is highly sensitive. In fact, so much so that by comparison to our data to what's been published in the literature, Ours is among perhaps some of the more sensitive labs out there in being able to detect the virus.
Yeah, so it gets into, you know, sensitivity and specificity, which is really important for clinicians. Is, you know, as we get further down the line and potentially offering very expensive treatments that are obviously going to be demanded by patients early in the disease process, we're going to really need a test that's highly specific and not only highly sensitive, right?
Right, exactly. And so I will say, right now, the test that we're running is indeed highly specific. In fact, some people may have heard concerns about false positives, and then also, more importantly, false negatives. And one of the things that's been really, again, a true testament to our virology team and all the faculty is that they have cross-validated their samples with multiple different platforms across other laboratories across the U.S., and they've been spot on. And, in fact, one of the things that they take great care in, and, in fact, I think pride, and rightfully so, is being able to make the right call. And so they've actually gone above and beyond to make sure that they're taking care to make the right calls so that the results coming back can truly be believed and acted upon.
Again, I'm going to remind our listeners, this is Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight, Dr. Randall Brewer. Our topic is the COVID-19 pandemic and how it is affecting our local listening area. We have two excellent guests with us tonight. We have Dr. Pooja Nambiar, Clinical Assistant Professor of Infectious Diseases here at LSU Health in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Chris Kevel, Vice Chancellor for Research here at LSU Health in Shreveport as well. You can call with any questions or comments at 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Kevel, I know we just have a few more minutes with you here on the air. One of the questions that came in was, I know you're not really on the epidemiology side of this, but when it comes to testing, it's a question that's asking, you know, does testing availability affect the epidemiological results that we're seeing? And so are the increases in COVID-19 cases that we're seeing here lately reflective of new cases or more so new testing availability?
So that's a good question. And I think Dr. Nambiar can give some comment on that as well after I say a few things. So, you know, it's important to keep in mind that the reality is when we do a test, we're looking at things that have already happened in the past. So the reality is just talking about, let's say, Caddo Parish, where if you go on the LDH website, you'll see that right now there's 336 cases with greater than 9,500 tests ran, which encompasses state tests and commercial tests. So you could see that when you do the math, the percent of individuals infected with the virus is significantly smaller. And the reality is, by comparison to other places like Orleans Parish or Jefferson Parish, but the reality is, in terms of the epidemiology, all the data that we're seeing is information that occurred in the past. So the reality is that we have to continue to test, because the only way that we're going to be able to keep up and stay abreast of what the virus is doing and where it's going and how it's being spread is to continually test. And in fact, in the public announcement that we made about the EVT lab, I use the phrase that the way to beat this is test, 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 because that is what gives us a better and clearer picture of the true burden, if you will, of coronavirus infection in our population. Now, there are other things on top of that need to be done by far, such as contact tracing and other type of epidemiological interventions. But right now, you can't do anything if you don't know where it is. So the key here for us, certainly in the next several weeks, is to continue testing. And actually, for the next several months, until there's a vaccine that's available, because what people are probably seeing in other countries is that now what's happening is that if they have robust testing programs in place, they'll back off of a little bit social distancing and other restrictions in the community, and then allow people to kind of come back to some normalcy, but they'll still continue the testing. And that's critical because otherwise, if they don't do surveillance to find out where the virus is going and identify hotspots, then all of a sudden the virus can get out of control again and we'll wind up back where we started.
So do you actually have plans for conducting surveillance testing now, or are we more so in the throes of testing symptomatic persons at the present time?
Great question. So right now we're adhering to the CDC criteria for testing so that we're testing symptomatic patients so that we can try to break the chain, if you will, of individuals that have the likelihood of infecting others. As time goes on, it's fully the anticipation is fully to do surveillance. One of the other things that the EVT lab is enabling us to do is to also begin serology testing, and that will begin standing up that technological capability next week with a bunch of other faculty in the Department of Microbiology and Virology. They have a true large bench of individuals that can help in this cause. And that will be really critical because when we're able to understand and identify people who have antibodies and who have now some immunity against the community may have already been infected by the virus and they were asymptomatic and they never knew it. But being able to identify those individuals who have an immunity to it means that's important because now we get to understand can those individuals go back in society and help contribute, do everything that they would normally do? But then in addition to that, they may be able to help with other things in terms of being able to treat individuals affected by coronavirus that perhaps are being affected disproportionately through something called a convalescent plasma program that we're in the process of talking about right now with others in the community.
Yeah, I mean, so many questions come to mind. I know Germany, I believe they're doing serologic testing to determine who can potentially go back to work practice the same amount of precautions as the general population. But yes, it seems to, the issues you mentioned with the strain variability and do strains actually have different virulence or different, pathogenic potential. Seems like there's a lot of questions that come up if you perhaps were asymptomatic with strain number one and then you get infected with strain number seven. Are you going to have cross immunity to that?
Right.
Like the HPV picture.
Yep.
Are we going to have to develop a multivalent vaccine or there's so many questions out there
I'm going to be honest with you. You're getting way out of my depth here. And unfortunately, I think you might need to have somebody such as Dr. Martin Sapp or Andrew Rajko to talk about that on another show. But you're absolutely correct. One thing I will say, if folks go on and look at where the mutations are in these various strains, fortunately, it hasn't mutated as much compared to some other viruses. And not being a certified card-carrying virologist, I have those conversations with my virology colleagues, and they say, well, this virus just hasn't been challenged enough by the human immune system, which is probably true. So it may mutate even more, but I do think that, and Dr. Tony Fauci has said this before, on various different interviews that, as he said, if you come through the, infection and you develop an immune response to it, he's highly confident that individuals who have developed an immune response to it will be immune in the future. But you're right. We still don't know. There could be variations, and time will tell, and we'll have to do more research to figure that out.
Well, Dr. Chris Kevel, it's really been a pleasure to have you on Health Matters tonight, and your insight and expertise is truly appreciated, and we all appreciate the work that you're doing there in the virology lab, the Emerging Viral Technology Lab here at LSU Health in Shreveport, and we will welcome you back in the future. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
All right. Thank you. Be safe. Bye-bye.
Dr. Nambia.
Yes.
So what do you think after, what we've been talking about with regards to testing, what sort of things come to mind?
So I totally agree with Dr. Dr. Kevel about, you know, when you spoke about epidemiology of the coronavirus, like for instance, in Louisiana today, we saw the highest spike up to date in the state. They had around 2,700 new cases. And we have to remember that this is not a surprise and this is what is expected because we have had a backlog of coronavirus testing. And these spikes really just show this amount of, you know, positive cases we've had, which are being tested now. And a lot of these tests are actually things that are in the past that we are actually seeing now. So a lot of this has to do with the jam, which is breaking now in terms of testing, and the numbers that we see are sort of, it can be very upsetting, but it appears to be because of the increase in testing here in the state of Louisiana.
Yeah, and it seems like that's sort of happened in most places, maybe New York being an exception, but there's such a large pent-up demand for testing. It seems like the epidemic's exploding, but perhaps it's just sort of increasing at a natural rate. Do we follow numbers of new hospitalizations outside of testing to compare those values?
So we do, in terms of local hospital epidemiology, we do keep track of all patients who come into the hospital and who are either admitted to the intensive care unit or on a regular floor. And we do follow hospital epidemiology numbers to see how many of these cases are actually hospitalized and how many have been followed by physicians in the community. So we have those numbers here for LSU Health, and we have been prepared for our current needs, because we know there's going to be a surge of cases over the next few days or weeks. And so there had to be a lot of surge plan with, you know, either additional beds and ventilators for the days to come. So, yes, we have to have those numbers. And it all depends on the prediction modeling that everybody keeps talking about. And the models help us predict when the pandemic will peak for Louisiana. So, for instance, the date that we have for our state is somewhere around April 10th to April 20th. And hopefully that's somewhere around the same time that we will peak to locally. And that'll be hard to tell exactly which date it's going to be. But these are numbers that we have to foresee so that we can plan ahead of, you know, our game in terms of what we'll be facing over the next few days or weeks.
And it seems that, you know, the governor was very aggressive when it came to, you know, stay-at-home orders in our state. You know, some states have just now adopted those orders, and we've had those for well over 10 days or so now. And it seems as though our local numbers here in Caddo were not quite the same as, you know, Jefferson and Orleans parishes. Do you think that will have a beneficial effect on our area here in northwest Louisiana, having those stay-at-home orders instituted earlier?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, the governor did a fantastic job of having the stay-at-home orders really early on in the game. And we also have to sort of remember that, you know, New Orleans, we had the Mardi Gras, and there was a lot of, you know, people from all over the country and world that participated in Mardi Gras. So that's one of the factors that we have to think about why we have an exponential in a number of cases in the South Louisiana. But what we're seeing is a, you know, community spread of cases. So most of our parishes now have cases. And this is because of, you know, of an extensive community spread. So by having a stay-at-home order, what we are going to achieve is basically stopping the spread, you know, in the community. So even the smallest of, you know, areas with lesser population are seeing cases. So it definitely will benefit the other parts of Louisiana by, you know, having the stay-at-home order.
Yeah, you know, and one of the questions that came up was, you know, what is the incubation period for COVID-19? And I read recently where it was determined that, you know, asymptomatic carriers can have a three-day period before symptoms develop, and then symptoms can be mild for an additional several days after that. And so is it true that the new cases we see today really are reflecting what happened a week or maybe even up to 2 weeks ago in terms of what that individual was doing in terms of limiting exposure.
You're absolutely right. The incubation period for coronavirus is around 2 to 14 days. That's a relatively long incubation period. So people may go days without actually knowing they're infected or they're actually carrying the virus. And that's exactly one of the reasons why COVID has spread so fast in the community and all across the country and the globe. So before patients can have symptoms, they could be just walking around not even knowing they're infected. So for instance, CDC just yesterday, they had reported that approximately 25% of the people infected with the novel coronavirus may not actually show any symptoms. And this explains exactly why we have this rapid spread across the U.S.
And, you know, Dr. Kevel mentioned the concept of a super spreader or maybe super shedder. Those are synonymous terms. Could you explain to our listeners what those concepts represent?
So the super spreader or the unwitted spreader, so these are patients who or individuals who are infected and they have the virus in their oropharyngeal or respiratory secretions, but they do not have symptoms. So the most common symptoms for COVID is fever or cough, shortness of breath, or maybe flu-like symptoms. And there are variations of these symptoms. Some patients can just have very mild symptoms, and they may just brush it off and say it's nothing, right? Well, some patients can have moderate symptoms that make them call their primary care physician or maybe come into the hospital if they're severely ill from the COVID. So there are a group of individuals who don't even know that they have it, and they may be going around actually spreading the virus, and because they don't have any symptoms. So they're called the unwitted spreaders, and we don't know who these people are because it takes a long time. The incubation period is almost 2 weeks. So it may take it may take 1 week or it may take 10 days before you actually have symptoms. So prior to that, you're actually walking around really not knowing that you have the infection.
You know, that's interesting to me. You know, how does a virus replicate and shed in an individual without the immune system mounting a response? Because it's causing cellular death, right? That's how it replicates and invades cells, takes over their DNA apparatus, and instead of making cellular proteins, it makes viral particles, and then the cells die. How does that happen?
So even in the data from, the Wuhan data that was published recently, what they've seen is the amount of viral particles in the respiratory secretions and the oropharyngeal secretions, increase over time, obviously. And this disease sort of it's a biphasic disease. So what the pattern that we are seeing, or sort of the trend that we are seeing among individuals, is that those who get the disease and have, a mild flu-like illness and get better, they actually just get better by week one and, they do well. But then there is another group of patients that after 1 week, they actually deteriorate over the course of the second week and they actually do, get really sick. And it's because of the cytokine storm, or what we call an inflammatory immune response, that causes all that the damage in the lungs and cause respiratory failure. So a lot of our listeners probably reading in the news or listening to things on TV about how it causes respiratory failure, and a lot of this is as the virus multiplies and in the lung tissue, it causes, because of all the inflammatory response, it causes what is known as acute respiratory distress syndrome. It's an immune response to the virus. And this is what, over time with the viral, replication, this is the sort of phenomenon we are seeing with the biphasic illness in COVID.
Is there any indication that certain individuals are at risk compared to others in terms of developing this cytokine storm? We know that obviously older individuals develop that. Is that because the older individuals have an immune system that is more apt to develop this storm?
So So there's a lot of, you know, initial data that said, you know, it's the elderly greater than 65, you know, those who have underlying conditions, heart and lung disease or diabetes, or those who have cancer. So they're the more susceptible patients to get really sick with the coronavirus. But in the U.S., we are seeing patients that are, you know, lesser than the age of 60, young, with not having that many comorbidities, also getting sick from the virus. As you know, we have to look at all the data that we are accumulating over the time here in the United States to actually say what are these risk factors and what is, you know, what are the kind of people who are getting sick with the coronavirus. And as of today, we don't exactly know which is that group and why they get sicker and what makes them more prone and makes them more sicker to the coronavirus.
Is there any chance that it's the viral load, as Dr. Kevel was mentioning, that could influence an individual's response? For example, getting coughed on if you're a healthcare worker and you don't have sufficient PPE.
Yeah, the inoculum of the of the virus definitely will make a difference. For instance, and that's exactly why they say, you know, the not having a PPE or being really in close contact with people, you know, the amount of virus that you inhale, you know, your immune system should be able to fight that amount of virus. That's the same case for most, you know, droplet and respiratory infections.
All right. Well, let's get to a few of the questions that have been sent in. One of the questions that's, I think, weighing heavily on the minds of many individuals here locally is, are our hospitals prepared? Will we have enough PPE? Will we have enough first responders, enough doctors and nurses in the emergency rooms and ICUs? And, you know, also, obviously, do we have enough ventilators or ventilatory capacity here in our local area?
So this is such a valid concern for people in the Shreveport-Bossier area. So in terms of, I can speak for, you know, LSU Health, and I have to say that we are currently we are prepared for our, you know, for our needs, and we also are prepared for the surge to come in the sense that we've had additional beds and ventilators. We've increased and ramped up our hospital bed capacity and even, you know, our ventilator capacities for the next few days and weeks. And for as of, you know, where we stand today, we do have the capacity to take care of people who have to be hospitalized with COVID. But as you can see, it's hard to predict where the peak is going to be and how many cases we are going to see as it surges. And that's very hard to predict what the numbers will be. And we can see all across the country that, you know, there is a shortage of PPE and hospital beds and providers. And hopefully we will be able to, manage with what we have, and only time can tell. But as of now, I should say that we are prepared and we do have surge plans.
Do we know in our local area what our experience has been in terms of what percentage of patients who get infected with the COVID virus actually get to the point of needing mechanical ventilation?
So we don't have that data from the U.S. as of patients who have coronavirus end up needing a ventilator. But we do have data from China that showed anywhere between 12 to 40% of the patients with coronavirus needed mechanical ventilation. And we don't have that data for U.S. as of yet.
In terms of what we're doing here in the Caddo-Bossier area, in terms of outside of ventilation treatment, what other avenues of treatment are available? Are clinical studies available for patients, or are we simply looking at, you know, symptomatic treatment with bronchodilators, mechanical ventilation, and oxygen and things along those lines?
So for mild cases of COVID where you have, you know, fever, mild flu-like illness, and cough, we say stay at home and rest, keep hydrated, and supportive treatment. But patients who have moderate illness where they have, you know, worsening symptoms or difficulty breathing and they are hospitalized, we are considering the use of, you know, hydroxychloroquine on case-by-case basis. People would have probably also heard of remdesivir, which is another drug which is in clinical trials. So if there are patients that we feel fit the criteria and they're critically ill and fit the criteria for remdesivir, we have asked either for compassionate care use of the drug in certain patient population, or we have we are able to enroll these patients in clinical trials. There are also a lot of clinical trials around the country that are looking at, you know, prophylaxis and hydroxychloroquine as treatment. Even with certain monoclonal antibodies and convalescent plasma. And as Dr. Cavill said, the lab at LSU, you know, their team is also looking at, you know, starting clinical trials for the, you know, for several treatment options. So those patients that are hospitalized and that are critically ill, it's on a case-by-case basis we make that decision for treatment options.
Yeah, the issue with, you know, convalescent serum or hyperimmune globulin concept, how far along are we with looking at that? You know, he mentioned, you know, how far behind they were in 1918 with regards to, you know, catching the epidemic and getting, you know, cases identified and contacts identified. It was just a horrific pandemic, and communication has advanced so much. Where are we with looking at convalescent serum? I've seen that come up more recently in the news.
Yeah, so we have some data again from China that looked at you know, around a very small case series of, you know, around five critically ill patients who had acute respiratory distress syndrome and severe pneumonia, who were treated with convalescent plasma transfusion, and they did in the clinical outcomes were good in that study. But again, that's a very, very small, you know, study population. There are institutes in the country that are using convalescent sera, we don't have data as of yet, but this is a very fastly evolving process, and there are a lot of scientists around the country that are working on it, but we don't have any data as of yet.
Okay, and I think everyone's probably aware that the governor did extend the stay-at-home order for the remainder of the month of April. And there's also some discussion, I believe, with the Centers for Disease Control in recommending some personal protective gear for the general public. In general, Dr. Nambiar, what's your take on the best methods that we can all do to prevent the spread of this virus?
So, you know, I'm sure everybody's heard this drill, right? Wash hands frequently, at least for 20 seconds. Make sure your web spaces are clean. You know, your thumb is clean. Avoid touching your face. If you're sick, you got to stay at home and cover your cough and sneeze, and clean or disinfect areas that you touch and you frequently use. And above all, we got to follow the social distancing rule. And if we have an order for, you know, a stay-at-home order, I think it's just our responsibility and to stay at home. And I think that's the only way that we can actually, you know, get success in, so, you know, sort of getting this under control. In terms of masks, and, you know, there's so much confusion in the public, I can totally understand, because initially we were told that we don't need masks, and now there's this whole, you know, reconsideration of whether we need masks. And we have to, with this significant community spread of COVID, CDC is actually reconsidering recommendations about wearing a mask. So the mask is not 100% effective, but yeah, sure, it is definitely beneficial. The big problem that we have here is, are there enough masks for everyone? And we have to make sure that, you know, the healthcare workers and the first responders, those who actually need it the most, have it. And also another concern CDC always had was that it may give people a false sense of security and make them, you know, less serious about social distancing. But, you know, I think CDC and WHO, they're going to, you know, sometime later today or tomorrow, they will come up with, you know, what they've decided about having the public wear masks. So I'll stay tuned on that one.
Yeah, you know, and obviously a big question is going to be, do we need to go and get the masks that the first responders and the emergency personnel need, like the, you know, the N95 mask, or is a, you know, scarf-like material going to be sufficient for, let's say, going in and out of the supermarket?
Yeah, so that to get an N95 mask is going to be quite challenging because we, even in hospitals across the U.S., you know, we don't have enough, you know, general surgical masks or N95 masks for healthcare providers. So it would be interesting to know how it's going to be very difficult for public to get these masks, and from where are they going to get these masks? So I've been asked about homemade masks, and obviously it's better than no mask, but it's definitely not as good as a medical mask. So it's going to be challenging once CDC says the public has to wear masks, because, you know, from where is everybody going to get those masks?
Yeah, I mean, especially people, you know, that, you know, want to do everything they can to prevent the spread. We all need to have a consistent message going forward, you know, what's the best thing to do. And
sure.
There does seem to be some mixed messaging. With regards, you know, to the way we're living our lives now, you know, we're going into the supermarket, but also there's a lot of opportunity for takeout food out there now as well. And some of the people who are listening have asked, you know, is it safe to get takeout food? We hear that the virus, you know, can sit on a box for a little while. Do we need to only handle things with special gloves? And do we need to sterilize our groceries or packages after they come to our homes? Any thoughts about some of these fomite issues with the virus and prevention?
So a lot of questions there. So I'll you know, with regards to takeout food, we have to remember that coronavirus is a respiratory virus. It's not foodborne. So you cannot get sick through food. However, there's a risk of acquiring the virus through the interaction with the person delivering your food. So if he or she is infected with the virus. So with takeout food, the food is fine, but you really don't know who's delivering the food. And, you know, if your interaction can expose you to someone who's asymptomatic and or someone who has the symptoms and may have the virus. In terms of sterilizing groceries or packages, again, corona is, you know, is a respiratory virus. So simple washing of fruits and veggies under running tap water with a little scrubbing should be fine. There's no need for sterilization. And also because of the poor survivability of these viruses on the surface, there's likely very low risk of spread from products or packaging. So CDC doesn't really advise, about disinfecting packages, but they just advise that once you're done, you know, grocery shopping or, you know, setting aside your produce or using the packages, and make sure you wash your hands. But there is nothing about sterilizing groceries or packages. So I think it's safe there.
Yeah, and one of the things that, you know, that comes up a lot is, you know, washing hands and touching surfaces is very important to do. But as you mentioned, the virus is not going to penetrate our skin, correct? And get
that's
into the
correct.
Bloodstream through hands. It's touching a surface that someone just coughed on within the past several hours, probably. And then getting it, not washing your hands, and then maybe, you know, biting your fingernails, for example, getting exposed to a mucous membrane from that standpoint, correct?
That's exactly correct, yep.
All right. Well, from the standpoint of anything else that we can do to prevent getting the virus, I know we'd love to have a vaccine and know when it's available. Are there, before you speak about, you know, what the potential is for a vaccine, could you... you know, comment about anything else that we can be doing to prevent the spread of the virus? Are there any herbal supplements, any vitamins, vitamin C, could that help us, or any other particulars that you would have come to mind with regards to prevention?
So there's really no data to support, you know, use of vitamins against coronavirus. But like I tell all my patients, you know, staying healthy, making the right lifestyle choices, whether it's about your diet or your exercise habits, and that'll all benefit in the long run. And, you know, we've always known vitamin C, you know, helps with the cold. But with regards to the coronavirus, there is really nothing, you know, to say that taking any specific supplements would help prevent getting coronavirus or, you know, help with the treatment of coronavirus.
And I see where, you know, some major news came out recently with regards, I think it was maybe University of Pittsburgh looking at a vaccine against the coronavirus. When do you anticipate that we'll have a vaccination program for this virus?
So it's just not one center, but the scientists, you know, all over the world are working on vaccines. So we have to remember that there are several, you know, dozens or more of, you know, different vaccines that they're talking about. And with regards to vaccination, what we have to remember is that it has to go through different phases of clinical trials, and it takes time for that. You know, we have to go through three phases of clinical trials, and that can take anywhere between 12 to 18 months before we have a vaccine. And another thing that we have to keep in mind is not just one is to make sure that it has the right, you know, immune response, you know, if you have to give it to an entire population. And it has to be safe, too. So it's not something that we're going to see over the next few weeks or months to come. It's definitely going to take a year, a little longer than that.
Okay, those are very excellent points with regards to the vaccination program. Do you have any idea what the level of vaccination recommendations would be with regards to a COVID-19 vaccine? Is it going to be, you know, sort of like the pneumococcal vaccine that is recommended for at-risk populations, or do you think it eventually will be more like the measles vaccine, where everybody should be vaccinated against it, since we think, you know, maybe 80% of cases are very mild and only a few cases are severe? What do you think the public health, takeaway is going to be?
I mean, this is a really good question, and it's too early and I don't have the answer for it, but from what I can sort of see in terms of, you know, the respiratory viruses, I think this would be something like the seasonal flu, where we want to, you know, vaccinate the population so that we can have herd immunity. And like most respiratory viruses, just like the Spanish flu in 1918, right, it came in the spring and it got better in summer, but it came back in the fall again. So there may be waves of the, you know, of the infection. And I feel maybe giving the entire population would, and, you know, either through infection or through immunization, we could have herd immunity. And that could definitely, you know, in terms of epidemiological spread, it would help, but it's just too early to say what exactly we're going to be seeing in the, you know, the years to come.
And it seems like, you know, what happens this summer in the Southern Hemisphere with respect to, you know, does it have antigen drift or shift, or does it behave more like the flu, or does it maintain its integrity in the Southern Hemisphere may be important for us looking forward to the fall, correct?
Yeah, yes. And this virus is, you know, when we had the 1918 influenza, it was novel, you know, at that time. And it's the same here. We don't know very much about the virus. All we know, the similarities between, you know, influenza and corona is that it's a respiratory virus, and, you know, it's it's coming from the animals, and it's the first time that's infecting human beings. And that's pretty much. And now we're learning as, you know, this evolves, we're learning along the way as to, you know, different medical aspects of this virus. But time will tell. We'll know when the summer comes if it's going to reduce, but we'll have to be really careful whether if it's going to all come back again in the fall.
Absolutely. Let's take one call, and then we have John from Fishkill, Louisiana. John, thanks for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hey, you guys are doing great work. I got two, one question quick is, I'm advising my family when they come home from, if they have walked through the store, to when they get to the house, take their shoe off and leave it out in the sunshine for a while. And the second part of it is, if we have groceries, not refrigerated, but plain groceries, and just leave them in the car for a day. Is that going to help matters any?
Hi, John. That's a great question. So, yeah, so in terms of non-perishable items, it's not a bad idea to just leave it there for, you know, the virus lives on surfaces anywhere between 1 to 3 days. So if you really don't need it for 3 days, you can just leave it out there and then use it after. So that's a great, you know, that's a great plan, actually. But obviously, if it's, you know, veggies and fruits and they're perishable, so you take it in, then you will do simple washing. And after you're done with all that, you will, you know, wash your hands and sort of disinfect yourself.
Yeah. Well, how about the stuff you carry home on the bottom of your shoes?
Oh, that, again, so coronavirus is a respiratory virus, so it's really what you inhale. And it's not, I think leaving your shoes out would be just hygienic things to do, and I don't really think that would be a real source of coronavirus. You have to be in close contact with someone with their respiratory secretions, or, you know, inhale or touch your face with the, you know, hand that's infected for you to actually get coronavirus.
Yeah, but the same thing's applying to the surface of these products you just bought. That stuff is on the surface of that product. Why isn't it on the surface of the floor and it's now on the bottom of your shoe?
Sorry, what was that again?
When you're walking through the store, somebody sneezed and spit that virus all over the place. It's on the floor as well as it is on these products you just bought. Oh, and you're walking in your house with those particles on the bottom of your shoe.
Yeah, so I would definitely advise for you to remove your shoes and not take it into the house. So normally what we do after, you know, come back from the hospital is basically, you know, leave all the, you know, leave your shoes and all the clothes that you've, you know, come from outdoors and sort of, you know, bathe and shower and, you know, sort of disinfect yourself. So that's something you definitely want to do.
Well, John, thank you so much for calling us this evening.
Now, thank you, guys. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. And Dr. Pooja Nambiar, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
As you know, Health Matters is a presentation of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. You can find updates for coronavirus for Louisiana, Arkansas, and Texas on our homepage at redriverradio.org. You can also find a podcast of this show and other Health Matters episodes on the website. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not reflect those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its staff. We would like to thank Mr. Kermit Poling and Wally Derlish for their assistance this evening. This program is made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Tune in again with us next week as we bring you more updates on the COVID-19 pandemic in our nation. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you for joining us this evening.
I don't know a soul who's not been battered. I don't have a friend who feels at ease. I don't know a dream that's not been shattered or driven to its knees. Oh, but it's all right, it's all right, for we've lived so well so long. Still, when I think of the road we're traveling on, I wonder what's gone wrong. Can't help but I wonder what's gone wrong. And I dreamed I was dying. I dreamed that my soul